The question comes up, why is life so unfair? I mean, there are times when it just rolls over us. I was reading a story written by a guy whose four-year-old daughter has a four-year-old friend named Caitlin who is dying. She has Batten's disease, which is a rare, it's an incurable congenital neurological disorder. It, essentially, her muscles petrify, and they are hard like wood, and then they become completely like stone. And they will harden until one day she will no longer be able to swallow or to breathe. Her parents, her brother, her grandparents, her aunts, her uncles, her cousins, her friends, her church family, their church family's church family, all watch this beautiful little Caitlin die a slow death, and there is nothing that they can do about it. Caitlin's mother is a Christian. She's drenched her bed with tears. She has beaten her fists against heaven's door, trying to get the owner to open up and give her bread that she needs. She attends a church full of godly, caring people, and they pray, and other people at all the other churches, they pray, and they pray for many things, strength for the parents, wisdom for the doctors, comfort for Caitlin, but most of all, they pray that God will heal Caitlin. God hasn't answered their prayers yet. And in truth, few think that God will. The people who live beside Caitlin, same town, same place, same neighborhood, right next door, recently won the lottery. It was more than $600,000. I know nothing about these people except that they have a lovely house. That the house, I'm told, is already paid for. It has been for a long time paid for. And so these people, I understand, have a good, abundant life even before they got their jackpot win. They have been on top for a long time. I'm not sure why they buy lottery tickets. I mean, that doesn't really matter why they buy them or other people buy them for them. It doesn't matter. But I'm not sure if they ever prayed to win the lottery or not, or if they ever pray at all, but they won the lottery and they got $600,000 out of it. And in the house next door, Caitlin is dying. And the question of the guy who was writing this article is very simply and very honestly, why? Where is the justice? Where is the equity? Why is life so unfair? And if you haven't asked that question, I think maybe you're just not being honest with yourself, because it is a basic question and it takes lots of different forms. How can there be a just and loving God when there is so much evil and so much suffering in the world? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? How can you continue to trust God when you face situations that don't make sense and seem to contradict everything that you know about God? Serious questions. And Soren Kierkegaard has said that Christians are like schoolboys who want to look up the answers and the math problems at the back of the book rather than work through the problem. When it comes to the questions of pain and suffering, you won't find the answers in the back of the book. There is no chapter entitled Four Simple Answers to the Problems of Pain and Suffering. Each of us have to work through the problems for ourselves and learn to trust in God in the middle of our pain, because we're all going to experience it sooner or later. For example, when you see a movie, you want to see justice done, right? That's what a happy ending is all about. We want to see anything that is wrong righted. We want to see the good guy win. Do you all remember when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, right? It's a long time ago. But the best ending of a movie, because the Nazis got it really bad. I mean, they melted. I thought, what? Good. That was good, you know, because they were really bad. You know, the movies that I don't like are the ones where the Nazis are really bad and they just get shot at the end. I mean, that's, come on, let's make them melt. That was pretty good. That was pretty good. But we feel cheated if the good guy, doesn't win. But we live in a world that is sometimes unjust. We learn early in our discipleship that whatever a person sows, he or she will also reap. But the truth of the matter is, we sometimes reap things that we do not sow. How many of you remember the name Arthur Ashe? He was a great tennis player, wasn't he? Yeah. Well, he had heart bypass surgery back in 1983. And back then, they were not checking blood samples for AIDS. And so he contracted, through the blood transfusion, HIV. And he did not suspect that he was infected until it was 1988, when he had to have surgery, brain surgery, actually when his right arm became paralyzed. And the surgery revealed that there was a parasitic infection that quickly led to this diagnosis of AIDS. He hadn't planned to reveal his illness until the time came when he would be noticeably changed by the disease physically, but USA Today demanded that he confirm or deny the rumor that he had it in 1992, and he, at the time, ranked 7th in the world before he was forced to retire. He bravely held a press conference, and he announced that he indeed was an AIDS victim. And like anyone else, Arthur Ashe could have was tempted to aim his rage at God, but he conquered that temptation. And speaking at the Niagara County Community College in the fall of 92, he testified to the place that Jesus Christ has in his life. This is what he said. "I have had a religious faith, growing up in the South and black and having the church as a focal part of my life. And I was reminded of something Jesus said on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me?" Remember, Jesus was poor and humble and of despised minority. I wasn't poor in that my father was a policeman, but we certainly weren't rich. And Jesus asked the question, in effect, of why must the innocent suffer? And I'm not so innocent. I mean, I'm hardly a perfect human being, but you ask about yourself, why me? And I think, why not me? Why should I be spared what some others have been afflicted with? And I have to think of all the good of my life, of having a great wife and daughter and family and friends and winning Wimbledon and the U.S. Open and playing for and coaching the Davis Cup team and getting a free scholarship to UCLA. All kinds of good things. You could also ask about this. Why me? Sometimes there is no explanation for things, especially for bad things. That's an extraordinary testimony, isn't it? There are no explanations sometimes for many of the bad things that happen, at least no explanation understandable by our limited brains. But we need to admit that sometimes innocent people suffer. Life is sometimes very unfair. And anyone who's lived any amount of time will learn this. Not all stories end in happy endings. It's simple, it's stark, and unpleasant. And I've searched all week for a way to say it that is softer, but the awful truth is sometimes life can be awful. Yesterday, of all things, you know, you picked this weeks ago. It fits into what I'm talking about. I'd already worked on this sermon for a number of weeks before I got a telephone call last week. Could we have a worship service, a funeral, a memorial service here in the sanctuary for a young man who'd never been here? He lived in New Smyrna Beach years ago, who was killed in a motorcycle accident up in Birmingham, 32 years old. His name, Michael. My son, who is 31, is named Michael. So I will tell you that I had a whole week of parallelism going on here every time I thought about this. But he died senselessly in a motorcycle accident, just lost control, hit one of those railings, and that was it. And the family sitting here, his seven-year-old daughter, his brother, and his brother's children, all sitting here in this sanctuary. Yesterday, the place was filled. What were they asking? They're asking that same question. Why? Why is life so unfair? Why did you get to live to the age that you are, and that young man, through no fault of anything, just living in a world where motorcycles can crash, is dead? It doesn't make any sense. Life can be so unfair. But I'm not going to leave you with that, because understand, I don't know if you're depressed, but I'm already depressed up here. I'll tell you this. this bottle of water down here, I hope it's water, because I could use something else, I'll tell you. Well, but I think that there is something that is beyond that, beyond the question of why not me. It was an extraordinary testimony that he shared with us. Life can be difficult. And this is very personal for all of us. People who lose control of their company, of the company of their wife that they dearly love, grandparents cheated of the years of joy, watching a grandchild grow, people who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own. It goes on and on and on. But there is something positive. First of all, sometimes suffering can be redemptive. It can be a springboard for something healthy. Let me say that, because not all the time, perhaps, but there are events in life that seem to have no redemptive characteristics, at least not from our perspective, but there is some truth to the expression that which does not kill me makes me stronger. That has been one of the things that David Dravecki had learned in his battle with cancer. Do you remember him? David, I'm using all these sports characters like I'm a big sports guy, but I know this one because he developed cancer in his pitching arm. And his career, which was very, he was with the San Francisco Giants, was very, very promising. He went under treatments and all of that. He tried to come back and lost his arm to the disease. From spending so much time in the hospitals, Dave said, I've learned that when we walk through someone's door who was suffering, we have to respect the sanctity of that room. And during his frequent stays at the hospital, he'd spoken with many other patients. They share their stories. They encourage each other. Something sacred happens, he says, when a person is suffering. It is when persons suffer that they turn to God for assurance, for answers, and for comfort. Spending time in hospitals gives persons a lot of time to think about what is really important, to reflect on their lives. God doesn't promise us a life full of mountaintop experiences, Dave said. We will also experience valleys in our lives as well, dark valleys, disorienting valleys, valleys of depression and despair. But Dave Dravecki had learned that God does not give us a map to detour the valleys of life, but rather God is with us in those valleys, beside us during those difficult times. He said, when we emerge from these experiences, we look back and we realize that there is where growth occurs. It isn't on the mountaintops above the timberline, it is in the valleys. And that is a wise analysis for somebody who suffered in his life. George Matheson, the great poet, developed what some kind of a wisdom. When his eyesight vanished, so did his fiancée. And 20 years later, he wrote this immortal hymn, O love that will not let me go. But he also penned these other meaningful words that are sometimes overlooked. He wrote, My God, I have never thanked thee for my thorns. I have thanked thee 1,000 times for my roses, but not once for my thorns. I have been looking forward to a world where I shall get compensation for my cross, but I have never thought of my cross as itself a present glory. Teach me the glory of my cross. Teach me the value of my thorns. Show me that I have climbed to thee by the path of pain. Show me that my tears have made my rainbow. That's beautiful, isn't it? Show me that I have climbed to thee by the path of pain. Show me that my tears have made my rainbow. Not everyone can thank God for their thorns. Some people just, it is too much pain. But sometimes life's most dreaded situations lead to a deeper and more profound relationship with God. Do you remember what Dravecki said? God doesn't promise us a life full of mountaintop experiences. We will also experience valleys in our lives as well, dark valleys, disorienting valleys. God does not give us a map to detour these things in life, but God promises to be with us in the middle of it. Doubtless there are some who have experienced that in your own life. And I love the way the Old Testament put it when Jacob was fighting God. You remember the story? Jacob was returning to his homeland to make peace with his brother Esau. His conscience was still bothering him about stealing the birthright from Esau. But Jacob also knows that through this brokenness, God has used him now to build a mighty nation, the nation of Israel. And the fight that he has with this stranger symbolizes for Jacob and for us the struggle to understand the mysteries of God and to make sense out of the brokenness of this world, to discover the course that God wants him to take. He struggles with God. And finally, God speaks to him and asks him his name and then tells us that he will have a new name, Israel. And from his name, a mighty nation will be born. Out of that struggle, a stronger, newer, better relationship with God was established. And then Jesus in our lesson shows us also this struggle with God. He again uses a shady character, a dishonest judge, to make a point about the goodness of God. This woman was wronged by someone, and her case was in court. We don't know the details, but the judge was a dishonest man. Wasn't in much of a hurry to settle the case, because the woman, being poor as women were in her day, didn't have any bribe money to help the judge along in deciding her case. So she keeps coming to him, asking to be vindicated, or in other words, that she has been given protection, justice, and her rights would be honored. And Jesus contrasts this dishonest judge with the loving father. If a dishonest person can be persuaded to make a decision, how much more likely will your loving Father in heaven listen to your pleadings, your struggles, and decide for you? Jesus is working from the negative, as he did in Luke 16 with the story of the unjust steward, to make a point about a loving God hearing our struggles, hearing our cries of help, and then responding to them. How do we do that? Well, prayer, of course, is one encounter with God. Not only do we struggle to bring from the depths of our souls our longings and our searchings and our inner feelings to God, not only do we struggle to lay before God, the throne of God, our very selves, but when we do that, we encounter God and we come in contact with God. Do you remember the movie Fiddler on the Roof? You remember? I wanted to show this to you, but you know there are like copyright issues about that, you know. But one of my favorite scenes of it was Tevye, the father, Tevye. I actually saw this portrayed. It was a very strange production, but it was by black Jamaicans portraying Russian Jews, and it was an absolutely fabulous production in Kingston, Jamaica, when I was there working. And it was delightful. They did such a beautiful job with it, but the accents threw me. It was Russian Jews speaking as black Jamaicans, yeah, but it's all right. Anyway, here's a man who knew how to talk to God. I love his prayer life. In Tevye, you could see that he was very human, just kind of a regular guy, common guy. But at the same time, he was wise beyond many so-called wise people of this world because he could see beyond the simple to the complex, the inner conscious of things. He also has a good relationship with his God. He's comfortable with God. He can talk freely with God about most any subject. His prayers to God are from the depths of his soul, and at times they are very humorous, but at the same time they reflect the concerns that he has for his life and the world around him. So let me just share one of his little prayers. He says, he's talking to God, "Today I am a horse. Dear God, did you have to make my poor old horse lose his shoe just before the Sabbath? That wasn't nice. It's enough for you to pick on me. Tevye, bless me with 5 daughters, a life of poverty. What have you got against my horse? Sometimes I think when things are too quiet up there, you say to yourself, let's see what kind of mischief I can play on my friend Tevye." He continues, he talks to God as he says, "As the good book says, heal us, O Lord, and we shall be healed." In other words, I'm breaking into a Russian accent, aren't I? Yeah, I'm not very good at that. Anyway, he says, "Heal us and we shall be healed." In other words, send us the cure. We've already got the sickness. I'm not really complaining after all. I mean, it's no shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either. So what would be so terrible if I had a small fortune? Can you? And then he sings, you know, "If I was a rich man," it's wonderful. Can you sense, though, the comfort that he has? The case that Tevye had in talking with God, maybe his theology wasn't the best, you know, maybe blaming God for all of his troubles, but his expression, his right to express these kinds of feelings to God is what prayer really is all about. Prayer is asking, prayer is wondering, prayer is bringing to God all of the feelings from the depths of your soul so that you may lay them before God, so that you might cry out from the inner longings of everything that is you, and all of your concerns, all of your problems, all the things that make us who we are and what we are. Prayer for us simply is an encounter with God, an encounter between our spirits and the Spirit of God, which comes to us in our prayers so that we might communicate with God. We encounter the same God of Jacob. We encounter the same God that Jesus points to in his story of the dishonest judge, the God of love, the God who cares for us, the God who indeed comes into a physical relationship with us in prayer. There's another poem I would like to share, and the author is unknown. It says simply, "The light of God surrounds me. The love of God enfolds me. The power of God protects me. The presence of God watches over me. Where I am, God is." I wish that was your experience, because I know there are times in your prayer life when you will knock at the door of heaven and your knuckles become bloody from the experience, and it seems that there is nothing there. And life is unfair. That young man, 32 years old, did not deserve what he had. He did not. And don't for a moment try to make it better by saying, well, it must be God's will. It was not God's will for him to run into a guardrail, however fast he was doing, fast enough to kill him. Don't believe that for a second. God was weeping on the side of the road that we live in a world where bad things happen. It is just the reality of a fallen world. That is just the reality. Nobody can make it better. It's just that way. There are moments when God will reach down and will change things. I don't know how that works. I'm going to talk to God. When I get there, I would ask for an explanation. And if there's any way, I'll send you a note so you'll know. But the reality is, and I'm not joking, of course, is that God is with us in the midst of all of that. I remember it was kind of a painful experience, and I talked to my mom about it a lot after it happened. But my first wife, Anita, who died back in 2012, she had a stroke while I was in seminary. She had a lot of things. She had strokes, heart attacks, all kinds of creative medical things. I got my second medical degree because of just taking her to the hospital. But she was a delightful, wonderful person. But she had a stroke. And I where do you go when you're a young man? I was in graduate school at seminary and all. And I called my mom. Isn't that what you would do? Call my mom. Say, Mom, this, you're not going to believe what happened. And her statement to me was, well, I guess God just wants to slow you all down. Something did not seem right about that, did it? Because I thought about it, and I talked to her years later about it, and I said, Mom, the one place that I can go when bad things happen to Anita is to God. And you told me God's to blame. I'll let that roll over you for just a second. Because God did not cause her to have a stroke. She had issues and some vascular things, and all, it doesn't matter. But God did not cause her to have it. But God was there with her and was with me. And do you see the difference? That if you're looking for someone to blame for the bad things, okay, that's okay. God can take that too. But the reality is God doesn't cause bad things so that you therefore will be good. Doesn't work that way. God promises simply to be there. If we expect life to treat us fairly, we're going to be disappointed. And if we dwell on it, I will tell you, we will probably become bitter people. Life is filled with injustice. The scales won't be balanced on this side of eternity. We will all experience hurts and sufferings that we don't do anything to deserve. God does not give us a map to detour these valleys, but God is with us. Will walk beside us during these valleys. In the midst of all the unfairness, in prayer, you and I encounter God. God's Spirit comes to us, mingles with our spirit so that we may be encouraged, so that we might be enabled, so that we might be strengthened to bring from the depths of our souls all those needs and doubts and struggles and joys and thanksgivings and celebrations, all the events of life, and bring them all into the realm of God. Prayer is simply a talk with God. It is a talk from the depths of our souls when we struggle to bring to God the essence of who we are. Prayer is an encounter with God in a very real, very powerful way. It is our spirit and His Holy Spirit mingling together so that our cries and our pleadings and our joys and our celebrations are presented to God. So God knows this. God seeks this with us, this relationship, a trust, a belief, a faith that tells us God will answer, God will respond because He so very much loves us. His faith, our faith, tells us to believe that the grace of God is simply sufficient. It is enough. God alone reaching His hand of love into my life and into your life is all that we need to trust as our steps go along the pathway of life. Let us turn to God in prayer. Now, before we do so, let me lift up a few people that we will keep in our prayers today. These came as a result of some visits. This is from Dick Hill. You see, he's asking for prayers for visiting a brother who is in the final stages of his life. So keep Dick in your prayers. And this is from Carolyn Peters for a granddaughter, Shay, who is very unstable at this time. And Buddy and Linda Stevens for our cousin who died trying to get to the hospital. Ooh, I don't know what the story there is. That sounds horrible. And then for their niece, Heather, who has stage 4 colon cancer. And she's 41 years old and lives in Georgia. Who else Can we lift in prayers? And tell us your name, because not everybody knows who you are. Dallas? Okay. Absolutely. Anyone else? Yes.
I recently talked with Hazel Henderly, who has moved permanently back to Ohio.
Yeah.
And she's been having a really hard time with aches and pains and back problems, and she really needs our prayers.
For Hazel Henderly, yeah. You attended here.
Formerly at first.
Yeah. Was here for a long, long time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Prostate cancer for your brother, Will. Okay. Right here.
I'd like to have prayers for the healing of our nation.
The prayers for the healing of our nation. Yeah. Any others? Of course. Oh, yes.
I have one more. My friend Shirley back in Massachusetts has a niece by the name of Sherry. And she emailed our church back home for prayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She needs to know. Yeah. Okay. And of course, we'll keep the family, Michael, who his name was Michael Pritzker. His mother is Diane Bean, and she lives over on Faulkner, so she lives here local. And yeah, and his daughter, Lillian. And so keep all of them, all the family, in your prayers as they go through that. And let's turn to God. Spirit of God, you choose to reveal yourself to us in so many surprising ways, so many unexpected places, that sometimes we fear that maybe you are dead or maybe hiding, and we grieve and we fear a future without you. So as we go about our daily jobs and our old routines and our simple tasks, but we find that you are there even though we don't recognize you. And in the preparation and breaking of bread with family and friends and strangers, we find you are there to strengthen us for everything that lies ahead. You call us to bid us to follow, and yet we still drag our feet and make excuses. We still do not know who you are and what it is you want us to do. But we profess our love for you, O God. And we confess that our love for you often falters and is timid. We are faithful when things are going well, when our nets and stomachs are full, but when we're not so faithful in the bad times. We bury our hopes and dreams in a tomb so deep and dark, and it is our fear that seals it up tight. But you return again and again and again to roll away the stones of fear and doubt. Forgive us for letting other things become more important than our love for you. Keep reminding us that if you love me, feed my sheep, tend my lambs, feed my flock, and follow me. And so it is in prayer that we, as the shepherds of this world, lift our prayers and entrust to you and your care our very lives. We lift in our hearts this day the names of those that are close to us and need your healing. We lift prayers of thanksgiving for time spent in our daily tasks and labors, even as we remember those needing meaningful work and renewed confidence in their lives. We lift up the ones you put on the road beside us, those that are hungry and thirsty, naked and strangers, and sick and the imprisoned. But then, of course, we lift up prayers for this world where we are so intimately interrelated with all of your other children and in a sacred balance with the created world. Help us to bless this world by caring for it responsibly. In your unexpected visits, you teach us the lesson of faithful service. You enable us to regain our sight and be filled with the Holy Spirit. May we be worthy of your great love for us by responding in love to others. When we recognize that this world is unfair and that things will happen to us that are beyond our control, we know that your presence is with us. And the way that we often feel that presence is through the loving arms of others. Allow this church to be that kind of a place Where one is hurting, others will gather around and be your loving arms. That the fairness of life will be restored in the sense that we are never alone, never left to fend for ourselves, but you are there. Allow us to be those arms, those hands of grace and love with each other, with this community. We ask this in the name of Jesus Christ, who taught us to pray at moments just as this: Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.